and welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, July 28th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. Ablaze in Humboldt. Fire destroys Yacht Club Trailers building. An electrical short on a motor at Yacht Club Trailers Monday morning quickly left the North 11th Street building engulfed in flames, deemed a total loss after firefighters from six departments battled the blaze for several hours. Humboldt Fire Department arrived on the scene at about 11:45 a.m. to smoke billowing through exhaust vents and chimneys with high levels of heat, according to Humboldt Fire Chief Jim Gronbach. The heat was too hot, Gronbach said. Firefighters started their attack by opening up the building with several holes on the exterior to allow cross-ventilation before paging for aid from departments in Gilmore City, Bode, Livermore, Renwick, Badger, and Fort Dodge. One of the Fort Dodge Fire Department's ladder trucks was paged at about 12:15 p.m. and used to quickly gain more control of the fire. "We went through the building and got the northern half of the fire knocked down," Gronbach said, "before moving further south, where main entrances face the 1400 block of 11th Street North. At approximately 1 p.m., a payloader plowed through the cornfield bordering the eastern side of the building near the source of the fire on one of the hotter sides of the building to allow fire trucks to blast water into the building at a better angle. It took firefighters about 4 hours to get the blaze under control in the building of roughly 50,000 square feet. The Humboldt fire chief estimated that the building was doused with about 100,000 gallons of water. Firefighters were still on the scene at 7 p.m., putting out hot spots. All of the company's approximately 80 employees were safely evacuated from the building without injury. "The building is pretty much a wide-open building, and there are no partition walls to stop the spread," Gronbach said. "Once the fire got going, it worked progressively down the line. A fair amount of the building was involved. Administrative offices had smoke damage, but the building was otherwise considered a total loss," Gronbach said. "The fire quickly spread in the building," employee Jared Evelyn said, "as it first went from the paint oven to insulators." Gronbach confirmed the source of the disaster. A motor on the trailer manufacturer's paint booth shorted out and blew an electrical panel. Most paint and propane used is stored outside the building. The manufacturer only keeps enough of the flammable paint inside the building to do a day's work, the fire chief said. Though a few propane bottles inside exploded, no firefighters were in the building to be affected, he said. Coating happens in the northeast end of the building, the farthest from the southern front entrance. Assembly runs on the south side, just behind administrative offices from north to south. Welding is conducted in the central portion of the building. Fort Dodge woman who died in Sunday fire identified. Jean Miller, 67, found unresponsive in smoke-filled apartment. The Fort Dodge Fire Department has released the name of the woman found deceased following a fire in her downtown apartment on Sunday afternoon. Jean Miller, 67, was found unresponsive in her first-floor apartment when firefighters arrived on scene at Central Place Apartments, 629 Central Avenue, just after 2 p.m. Sunday. Inside, they were met with heavy smoke. Miller was pronounced dead at the scene from injuries sustained in the fire and has been transported to the state medical examiner's office. A neighbor in the apartment building had smelled smoke coming from Miller's apartment and called 911. According to FDFD Chief Steve Hergenruder, the fire was mostly out and in the smoldering stage when firefighters arrived. The fire was contained in the kitchen area and there was moderate smoke damage to the apartment, Hergenruder said. The fire did not spread to other apartments in the building. Hergenruder said that the building-wide smoke alarms were not activated because the smoke from the fire did not spill out into the hallway to trigger the hallway alarm. In a higher occupancy building like that with multiple dwellings, the way the alarm system works is each apartment has smoke alarms in it that activate within that dwelling unit, he said. The hallway corridor alarms, if smoke gets out there, it activates one of those alarms and then it goes through the building. He said the alarms operated normally. The cause of the fire is still under investigation. Fort Dodge man pleads not guilty to attempted murder. Williams accused of stabbing man in neck, back. A Fort Dodge man accused of stabbing and seriously injuring another Fort Dodge man earlier this month pleaded not guilty via written plea on Monday. Police say on July 2nd, Danatha L. Williams, 41, stabbed another man in the neck and back, causing serious injuries. He is charged with attempted murder, a Class B felony. The 39-year-old victim, who has not been named, walked into the Community Health Center of Fort Dodge, 126 North 10th Street, with stab wounds to the neck and back just before 11 a.m. on July 2nd. The victim was treated at the CHC until medics arrived. The initial investigation found that the victim had been stabbed in his apartment building on the same block as the CHC before fleeing to seek help. The victim sustained serious but not life-threatening injuries and was transported to Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center for further treatment. Williams was arrested and charged with attempted murder later in the day after video surveillance showed Williams involved in an altercation with the victim in the Biltwell apartment building, 106 North 10th Street. According to the criminal complaint for the charge, a very apparent trail of blood led officers to the scene of the crime. Williams' trial is set to begin on December 15th. City offers new way to help citizens clean up. Program will continue through August. There will be a modified cleanup day collection in Fort Dodge this fall, but an ongoing bulk pickup program may prove to be the preferred method of getting rid of large refuse items in the future. A combination of the fall cleanup and the bulk pickup program could replace the annual junk days collection held for years in April and May. The COVID-19 pandemic prompted the cancellation of this year's spring cleanup days collection. City Manager David Fierke told the City Council Monday that the collection was canceled to prevent COVID-19 from spreading through the ranks of the Public Works Department as employees worked side by side to pick up all the material. To provide a disposal option, a system was set up in which residents who are city sanitation customers can contact the Public Works Department to arrange for pickup of large items on the same day that their recycling materials are collected. The program began in June and will continue through August. It offers free collection of furniture, mattresses, carpet, dismantled swing sets, bikes, scooters, and large toys. Passenger car tiles will be collected for $5 each. TVs and other electronics will be picked up for $15 each. Fierke said Monday that there has been nothing but positive feedback on the program. He reported that 32.4 tons of material has been collected. The collection has cost $2,460 while generating $1,365 in revenue. Fierke reported that the typical spring cleanup collection days require the commitment of the entire Public Works Department staff. The summer program requires only a couple of workers to do, allowing regular maintenance work to go on as scheduled. According to figures presented to the council, the 2019 spring cleanup days cost $93,477.12 to complete. So far, this summer's program has cost $28,427.20. Councilman Nevin Conrad said officials were adamant that there would be a cleanup collection in the fall when they announced that the spring one would be canceled. He joined Mayor Matt Bemrich, Councilman Kim Allstadt, and Councilman Terry Menke in stating that the city should have a fall collection. But they all indicated they were open to the possibility of having a bulk pickup throughout the summer of 2021. The dates for this fall's collection haven't been set yet. But when the collection is held, it will be different from past pickups, according to Councilman Jeff Halter. He said only large, bulky items will be picked up. Bags of garbage and other small, loose items will not be picked up. Junk days is not going to be the way people envision it to be, Halter said. Asbestos work set at Wakansa Annex. Project to be done by end of year. Hazardous asbestos will be removed from the vacant Wakansa Annex in downtown Fort Dodge as a preliminary step toward the eventual demolition of the building. The City Council on Monday hired REW Services Corp. of Des Moines to do the work at a cost of $340,270. The work is expected to be done by the end of this year. The city previously received a $500,000 grant from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to pay for the work. Some of that money has already been spent to hire experts to analyze the scope of the asbestos problem and prepare plans for removing it. Asbestos is a substance that was once commonly used to insulate buildings. Medical researchers have linked it to lung cancer and other lung diseases. In the Wakansa Annex, it has been found in the floor tiles, pipe insulation, electrical wire insulation, and the drywall compound. The Wakansa Annex is a 7-story building that appears to be part of the adjacent Warden Plaza. That building was obtained by the city government in 2016, when it also obtained the Warden Plaza under the terms of the state's abandoned buildings law. A plan for rejuvenating the north side of First Avenue South between 9th and 12th Streets envisions taking down the Wakansa Annex to make way for a parking ramp called an intermodal hub. That intermodal hub would link a renovated Warden Plaza and a planned cultural and recreation center. But progress on that plan is stalled. The owner of the Warden Plaza, KDG LLC of Columbia, Missouri, hasn't done anything with the building since acquiring it in 2016, prompting city officials to threaten to take it back. The city was unsuccessful in getting a federal grant to help pay for the intermodal hub. Councilman Dave Flattery and Andy Fritz were absent from the otherwise unanimous vote to award the contract. Other bidders for the job were Controlled Asbestos Inc. of Des Moines with $354,541, Advanced Environmental Testing and Abatement Inc. of Davenport at $396,000, Echo Midwest Inc. of Hastings, Minnesota at $420,685, Environmental Property Solutions of Urbandale at $439,450, Iowa Illinois Taylor Insulation Inc. of Davenport at $500,174, Site Services Inc. of Algona at $881,300, and Environmental Assurance Company Inc. of Indianapolis, Indiana at $875,000. News brief. Audit of FD City Government complete. An audit of the City of Fort Dodge was recently completed by Cornwell Fredaires Mayor and Associates PLC. The audit found that the city government's revenue totaled $61,075,998 for the fiscal year that ended June 30, 2019. That is a 10.4% increase from the prior year. The auditors reported that the increase in revenues was primarily related to an increase in charges for service due to the city taking over the ambulance service, plus utility rate hikes and more grants being received. The city's expenses totaled $50,631,013 for the fiscal year that ended June 30, 2019. That was a 5.3% increase from the prior fiscal year. A copy of the audit can be found at auditor.iowa.gov/audit-reports. A news brief. Pulled pork fundraiser in Harcourt Saturday. There will be a pulled pork fundraiser from 4 to 7 p.m. Saturday in the Harcourt City Park. The menu is pulled pork, baked beans, potato salad, homemade ice cream, and an assortment of pies. Take your dinner to go or eat in the park. Picnic tables will be spread out so that social distancing can be observed. A free will offering will be accepted. All proceeds will be used for repairs to the Lost Grove Community Center in Harcourt. An editorial. Girls softball returns to Fort Dodge. This annual state tournament is a highlight of the summer season. One of the summer's most enjoyable events is underway. The girls state softball tournament will be the highlight of the season for the teams that made it to state-level competition. All the teams are outstanding. Making it to this final event of the season means that none will have any reason for more than a brief lament, no matter what their final standing. Making it to state is itself an accomplishment that marks a season as one to remember with pride. This event has become a major feature of the summer sports season in our town. Fort Dodge has been the host city for this competition for 50 years. The marvelous Harlan and Hazel Rogers Sports Complex has been the selected venue for the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union softball finals for so long that it is hard to imagine any other location for this event. We're pleased the IGHSAU leadership agrees that the superb facilities at Rogers and the other amenities Fort Dodge has to offer can't easily be topped. It is also very good news for the economy of Fort Dodge and the surrounding towns. The Fort Dodge Convention and Visitors Bureau shared with the Messenger data regarding this tournament's financial impact on the local economy. The numbers are impressive. Over the course of the tournament, thousands of people will visit Fort Dodge. This will have about $1 million in direct financial impact, the money spent by these visitors. This will add millions in indirect stimulation to the local economy. The money visitors will spend here will help pay salaries and generate profits for businesses. Much of the money that goes out in payrolls and is earned by businesses as profit is plowed back into the local economy. It's not hard to see evidence of the direct spending. Hotel rooms will be filled this week not only in Fort Dodge, but also in nearby towns. Anyone who visits a restaurant this week will learn firsthand that local eateries benefit greatly from this event. The money spent in stores, gas stations, convenience stores, and the assorted other places where visitors shop helps strengthen these local businesses. When local businesses do well, so do we all. The investment this community made in the Rogers Sports Complex is an excellent example of creative planning. When communities invest in carefully crafted infrastructure projects, they set the stage for future economic growth. This will be a great week for fans of girls' softball. It will also be a wonderful demonstration that Fort Dodge is not only open for business, but also knows how to compete in that world like a champion. The Messenger welcomes the competitors and their supporters to Fort Dodge. Fort Dodgers are excited to have the teams and their fans as a part of our community for a few days. Win or lose, this will be a week filled with outstanding softball that will generate both great fun and treasured memories. A letter to the editor. Wonders why some don't wear masks. To the editor. I can't figure out why some people don't wear masks in public. I don't know if it's a lack of respect, defiance, or ignorance. My wife and I wear masks when we are out in businesses and among people. We do it out of respect for others, a want to stay healthy, and the scientific facts of COVID. We do it out of a sense of civic duty to help keep all people safe. Where is the sense of duty of people that do not wear a mask? If someone does not want to wear a mask for some foolish reason and our governor refuses to do the right thing, then so be it. However, there is no reason that we can't do the right thing ourselves. If you choose not to wear a mask, at least respect those of us that do and socially distance. It is maddening to have someone without a mask step right up to you, oblivious to the rest of the world. I wonder if local businesses know how much business they have lost because people don't want to have to deal with the aggravation of going out in public to buy necessities directly due to unmasked patrons. There is no good argument for not wearing a mask in public. The idea of personal freedom rings hollow. People can't go into many stores or businesses without shirt or shoes. People can't go into these same places and light up a cigarette. Same thing. How about the rights of people that don't want others' germs during the pandemic? It's just a piece of cloth over the mouth and nose. They can be one of a kind, make a fashion statement, etc. This is about other people's rights, too. Politicizing it is a fool's game. A medical condition could be an exception, but I don't know what kind of condition would negate mask wearing. So, if you wear a mask, thank you for doing the right thing. If you don't wear one, you should be. But if you think you have the right not to, at least be responsible enough to stay at least 6 feet from those acting responsibly. I think it boils down to caring. People that wear masks care about others, while it certainly appears those that don't don masks only care about themselves. Signed, Al Deal, Fort Dodge. A letter to the editor. Thankful for the police. To the editor. Every time I hear a police siren or notice a police car cruise by my home, I am so thankful and comforted that our officers are out there striving to keep our citizens safe and protected. A million thank yous to you all. Signed, Diane Williams, Fort Dodge. Breakout. Shutout win has Dodgers in semis for the first time since 06. One at-bat sometimes defines a game. For top-ranked Fort Dodge on Monday at the state softball tournament, one at-bat did just that, and also showed the grit and determination that epitomizes its program. Dodger pitcher Jalen Adams had that moment at the plate during her team's 7-0 victory over Bettendorf in a Class 5A quarterfinal at Rogers Park. Fort Dodge, who are 27-3 overall, will now face number 6 Ankeny Centennial, who are 22-8, in the 5A semifinals on Wednesday. First pitch is slated for 12:30 p.m. on Dodger Diamond. The Dodgers, who are making their third straight state appearance and 16th overall, won a first-round contest for the first time since 2006 by blanking the Bulldogs, who were 19-7. "We were a lot more comfortable," Jalen Adams said. "We felt more relaxed and more confident. I felt we wouldn't lose. I had a lot of faith in my sisters." Fort Dodge has reached the state tournament 11 times under head coach Andy Adams. The Dodgers are in line to at least tie their best state finish in school history. "I usually don't cry, but this cracked me," Andy Adams said. "We are our own little pack. They were calm, cool, and held their composure. They're ready for this." In the third inning of a scoreless contest, Jalen Adams fell behind in the count with two quick strikes. Adams then dug in and kept fighting off pitch after pitch from Bettendorf's Sofia Del Vecchio. After seven foul balls and 13 pitches, Adams connected, blasting her first home run of the season to dead center to score Sofia Klinger and put the Dodgers up 2-0. Adams happily skipped around first and second, and after crossing the plate, received a big hug and kiss from her emotional mother. The ice was broken, the pressure lifted. "My mom doesn't cry very often, but I saw tears," Jalen Adams said. "We wanted to win for each other and her. She put so much work into this. She cares for all of us, and we care a lot about her." Heading into the state tournament, Adams had played in 115 games at the varsity level, accumulated 366 at-bats and 172 hits, a .470 career batting average. She had homered only once before Monday. "Jalen is a terrific hitter. She just went up there and did a great job," Andy Adams said. "She knows what to do. When she hit that out, I was just happy for her and for the fact that we were finally on our way." The long ball took the wind out of the sails of the Bulldogs as the Dodgers tacked on five more runs in the next two innings. "We play with high energy," Jalen Adams said. "Once we get going, we just keep going." It was junior Chloe Wirtz's turn in a clutch situation next. Wirtz, hitting out of the eighth spot in the Dodgers lineup, delivered a big two-out hit to score sophomore Haley Wills and classmate Malia Lowry. In the fifth, Fort Dodge's career home run leader, senior Logan Schnetzer, laid down a sacrifice bunt to score sophomore Maya Davis and put the Dodgers up 5-0. The final blow came when Wills laced a double to the outfield fence, scoring junior Tristan Doster and sophomore Martine Lowry. "I was hoping it was going to go out," Wills said, "but it was still a good hit to score some runs. This team plays so well together and we get along really well. I'm proud of my team. Coach Adams worked so hard to get us prepared. We did this for her." Adams, who is 19-1, was brilliant in the pitching circle as the Bulldogs were unable to connect much with the Dodger ace. She allowed only two hits and two extra base runners on walks. The sophomore fanned eight batters in all, including five through the first three innings. She took a perfect game into the fifth before allowing a single. Adams got into one jam in that frame, but Wills caught a line drive to stymie the threat. "We were so loose," Andy Adams said. "These girls put a ton of work in. I feel it for them. They truly do it for each other and play together as a family." Wills, Adams, and Wirtz finished with two RBIs each. Wills had two hits. Adams, Wirtz, and junior Sofia Klinger contributed hits as well. An emotional goodbye. Humboldt bows out in 3A state quarterfinal round versus Mount Vernon, 7-4. For every hard-hit ball by Humboldt Monday night, a Mount Vernon defender was there to cleanly field it. The Mustangs used that near-flawless defense, along with timely hitting and a late grand slam by Nicole Sullivan, to stun the Wildcats and their large contingent inside Rogers Park, 7-4. Mount Vernon, 21-4 overall, advances to the Class 3A semifinals on Wednesday, where it will face number one seed Albia, 20-1, at 4:30 p.m. on Dodger Diamond. For Humboldt, who were 20-3, it marked the crushing end to the careers of eight seniors who were part of five consecutive North Central Conference titles and three state tournament berths. "This group, they never gave up and they never stopped fighting," Humboldt head coach Doug Van Pelt said. "Even there in the seventh, after giving up those runs, they battled until the very end. That's because of the incredible senior leadership we have. Those girls have given so much to this program over the years." The Mustangs struck first with a pair of runs in the opening inning, rattling three hits off Ellie Jacobson, including a 2-RBI double by Mandy Moracle. In the third, the Wildcats answered as Jacobson drove and Carly Thompson. Jacobson, who is headed to Des Moines Area Community College in the fall, went the distance, striking out 8 without a walked batter. During her Humboldt career, she surpassed the 100-win and 1,000-strikeout marks. Holding a slim 2-1 lead in the seventh, Mount Vernon plated 5 runs, with 4 of them coming on the Sullivan slam. The DePaul commit has 3 homers this season and driven in 33 runs. Even after that happened, these girls never gave up or hung their heads, Van Pelt said. They went out there in the seventh and scratched and clawed to get back in it. Humboldt did just that, as Alexis Hansen worked a walk and eventually came around to score after hits by Thompson and Jory Hajek. Kendall Clark, who won a state wrestling championship this past winter, connected on a 2-RBI single, but again, the Mount Vernon defense made a key play. The Mustangs relayed the throw from the outfield perfectly to second, getting the third and final out. Thompson, who is headed to Iowa Central, and Jacobson each had 3 hits in their final games at HHS, while Hajek, a junior, also recorded 3. Clark finished 2-for-4 with 2 RBIs. Fort Dodge School Board okays face covering purchase. District to buy 4,300 face masks. Every student and staff member in the Fort Dodge Community School District will receive a face covering to use during this school year to help protect against COVID-19. The district's Board of Education approved the $12,900 proposal to purchase 4,300 face masks in assorted sizes from Optic Inc. of Fort Dodge on Monday night. The masks will be double-layered cloth masks, Superintendent Jesse Ulrich said. These are good quality, Ulrich said. Students and staff will be encouraged to use the face coverings when social distancing is not possible. The cost of the face coverings will come out of the district's general fund. School Board President Stu Cochran asked if there was any outside funding from the state or federal governments to pay for the masks. Ulrich answered that the money from the CARES Act that the district received went into the district's general fund. Ulrich added that the district will also be purchasing face shields for teachers who request them. The school board also approved a change order for the new central office and maintenance facility project, totaling $20,070.60. The change order will cover additional Americans with Disabilities Act parking and pavement replacement in the building's parking lot. Prior to the start of the project, the district did not know that the cement in the parking lot did not meet ADA requirements, Ulrich said. The other major discussion the board had on Monday was on the district's return to learn plan. When Governor Kim Reynolds released her proclamation on July 10th, requiring districts to have at least 50% in-person instruction, the Fort Dodge district was forced to reevaluate its hybrid learning model. The hybrid learning model originally called for having students divided into Group A and Group B, with Group A receiving in-person instruction on Mondays and Tuesdays, and Group B on Thursdays and Fridays. As that original hybrid model does not meet the governor's requirements, the district is working on revisiting it, but Ulrich is asking families to be patient. We are waiting on some guidance that we need before we get in front of families and try to answer questions, he said. Ulrich added that he knows that this is a frustrating situation for families and staff, but until the district receives guidance, it doesn't have any answers. Ulrich said, though the district will be doing its best to try to prevent the spread of COVID-19 within classrooms, there's still the possibility of infection. Fort Dodge schools will have a safe and healthy environment for our students and staff, Ulrich said, but we cannot guarantee that COVID won't be in our schools. While the Fort Dodge District continues to work on the Return to Learn plan and await state guidance, the district is meeting families of students with special needs to make sure each child's needs are met. Ulrich said a lot of things will likely change between now and the school board's next meeting on August 10th. You are listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, July 28th, 2020 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Howard Corey. Howard W. Corey, 85, of Colville, passed away peacefully on Saturday, July 25th, at his home surrounded by his family. Services will be 11 a.m. on Saturday, August 1st, at the Gunderson Funeral Chapel, with Reverend Jenna Finch Manchester officiating. Burial will be in the Otho Cemetery. Visitation will be from 9 a.m. until 11 a.m. on Saturday at the Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Fort Dodge. Those attending the visitation and service are encouraged to wear masks and observe physical distancing. Howard is survived by his two daughters, Kimberly Pert and spouse Don of Colville, Joanne Lennon and spouse Larry of Duncombe, his 10 grandchildren, Nick Corey, Alexa Eastwood and spouse Chase, Ashley Heineke and spouse Jory, Amanda Pert, Joshua Pert and spouse Katie, Karen Hayes and spouse Josh, Patrick Lennon, Stacy Gannon and spouse Joel, Joseph Lennon and spouse Chelsea, and Thomas Lennon, and 10 great-grandchildren. He is preceded in death by his parents, his wife Carol in 2018, and their son Shane Corey in 2019. He is also preceded in death by his four siblings, Richard Corey, Shirley Councilman, Marilyn Bell, and Lloyd Butch Corey. Howard Wayne Corey, the son of Howard F. and Hester Bowles Corey, was born October 21, 1934, in Lake City. Howard lived in Lake City before he and his family moved to Deer River, Minnesota. He graduated in 1954 from Deer River High School. The following year, Howard joined the United States Army and served in Germany. While in the Army, he started boxing. During his time boxing in the Army, Howard was a Golden Glove winner. Howard received his honorable discharge in 1958. On June 28, 1958, he was united in marriage to Carol Cater in Deer River. After their marriage, the couple made their home in Fort Dodge. Howard was employed with Iowa Illinois Gas and Electric as an electrician. He worked there for 38 years before his retirement in November 1995. Howard was a member of the Otho United Methodist Church and later Trinity United Methodist Church. He loved the outdoors. Hunting, fishing, gardening, and woodworking were some of his favorite things to do. He also raised and trained black labs for field trials. Austin Mallinger. Please join us in celebrating the life of Austin Jeremiah Mallinger, who passed away July 26th. He experienced a long and wonderful life and touched the hearts of everyone he met. He was preceded in death by his parents, Michael and Margaret Mallinger, and his six siblings, Eileen Callahan, Tom Mallinger, Margaret Condon, Steve Mallinger, Sister Mary St. Stepan, and Lorraine O'Leary. He is survived by his wife of 72 years, Margaret Sullivan Mallinger of St. Paul, Minnesota, three daughters, Jane Williamson and spouse Kurt of St. Paul, Minnesota, Nancy Mallinger and spouse Jeff Engberg of Big Lake, Minnesota, and Mary Ankerstern and spouse Kirk of St. Paul, Minnesota, and Dan Mallinger and spouse Marina of Windermere, Florida. Austin was born and raised in Webster County and met his beloved wife through family members. He started his life farming and then moved on to the transportation industry, where he spent the majority of his life. Austin was best known for his kind and gentle attitude. He was willing to experience new things, including having a home at Twin Lakes without knowing how to swim, traveling to China and Ireland with his family, and being involved in the lives of his children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. The services celebrating his life will be limited to close family members due to present COVID-19 circumstances. If so inclined, please make donations to the Scholarship Fund at St. Edmund High School. The funeral will be live-streamed via Lofersweiler Seavers Funeral Home Facebook page Thursday, July 30th at 11 a.m. Evelyn Mansager. Evelyn Mansager, 101, of Dallas Center, formerly of Emmitsburg and Fort Dodge, passed away Thursday, July 23rd at Spurgeon Manor in Dallas Center. Graveside services will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, July 31st at North Lawn Cemetery in Fort Dodge. Please note the change of date. Charles Chuck Coleman. Charles Chuck Coleman, 67, of Otho, died July 26th after a brief yet courageous battle with cancer. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday at Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services. Funeral services will be held 10 a.m. Friday, July 31st at Gunderson Funeral Chapel. Interment will be held in St. Paul Cemetery, Manson. Joan W. Stumpf. Joan W. Stumpf, 88, passed away Monday, July 27th at her home. Funeral services are pending at the Palmer & Swank Funeral Home, Rockwell City. Thomas R. Oxenrider. Thomas R. Oxenrider, age 48, of Lawrence, passed away on Sunday, July 26th at the Trinity Regional Medical Center in Fort Dodge. Memorial services will be 10:30 a.m. Friday, July 31st at Bethany Lutheran Church in Lawrence, with Pastor David Klappenbach officiating. Burial will be in Lawrence Cemetery near Lawrence. Visitation is 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Friday, July 31st at the Bethany Lutheran Church in Lawrence. Powers Funeral Home in Lawrence is handling the arrangements. For online condolences and obituary, please visit powersfh.net. Centennial reaches semis. Jaguars rally to knock off Waukee in CIML showdown. When Ankeny Centennial head coach Brett Delaney said his team found a little luck Monday afternoon at the state softball tournament, he wasn't kidding. Down to their last five outs and trailing 2019 state runner-up Waukee in the sixth, the Jaguars staged an incredible comeback, highlighted by a two-run homer from Ella Schultz to defeat the Warriors 5-2. Ankeny Centennial, who are 22-8 overall, now meets top seed and tournament host Fort Dodge, who are 27-3, on Wednesday at Rogers Park in a Class 5A semifinal. First pitch is set for 12:30 p.m. on Dodger Diamond, one of the mini-major fields, which is not the regular home for the Dodgers. Down 2-0 in the top of the sixth, Schultz launched an Ellie Bates pitch towards the left field fence. As the Warrior outfielder tracked it, the ball hit her glove and bounced over for a home run, tying things at 2-2. The Jaguars used that momentum to plate three runs in the top of the seventh and cement the thrilling come-from-behind victory in their state debut. They have won six in a row since a loss to Johnston late in the regular season. "Lately, we've been waiting for the later innings to score," Delaney said. "We were never in panic mode. The girls were excited to play. We took advantage of some small things and got a couple lucky plays to go our way. I was impressed with our outcome because that was a very good Waukee team." Maddie Huseman, who is headed to Iowa Central in the fall to continue her career, earned the win inside the circle for Ankeny Centennial, striking out two over seven innings and scattering nine hits. Schultz and Taylor Runchy, who recorded a two-run double in the seventh, each had a pair of RBIs, while Mackenzie James collected two hits. Delaney, in his second season as head coach, knows another stiff challenge awaits his club on Wednesday. "Fort Dodge has been one of the top teams in the state all year," he said. "We are excited to see to get the opportunity to compete against them and be on the same field. The girls will be ready and they are excited to play. Hopefully we find ways to get another victory." For the Warriors, Reagan Bartholomew and Michaela Hannum each had two hits, with Ava Smith and Hannum recording an RBI during the two-run first. Bates finished with five strikeouts, and Maddie Etzman struck out three in an inning of work. Waukee has reached the championship round in each of its previous three trips to state, claiming the title in 2015. Muscatine takes out defending champs. A new queen will be crowned in Class 5A after Muscatine knocked off defending state champion West Des Moines Valley here Monday afternoon, 3-1. On a perfect day for softball, the Muskies used runs in the fifth and sixth to stun the Tigers at Rogers Park. Muscatine, 19-2 overall, now faces Cedar Rapids Kennedy, who are 24-1, on Wednesday at 11 a.m. on Veterans Diamond in the semifinals. Kylia Sawyers got Muscatine going in the first, plating Olivia Harmon with a double with two outs. She helped the Muskies score the game-winning run in the sixth after the Tigers, who are 23-5, tied it in the third. Muscatine added an insurance run in the sixth in support of pitchers Mara Chalupa and Bree Seaman. Chalupa struck out two in just over four innings of work, with Seaman picking up three strikeouts in two-plus innings. Harmon was 3-for-3 with a run scored, while Sawyers, Erica Ramser and Carly Ricketts had two hits each. Ramser and Malia Cook scored runs. Muscatine, which ended a five-year drought from the state tournament with a win over Iowa City High in the regional final, won the Mississippi Athletic Conference title this past season. The league produced five state tournament teams in all. Valley was making its eighth consecutive trip to the state and in search of title number 7 under head coach Tom Bakey. Alex Honnold, who is headed to Missouri to play softball, had two of the three hits for the Tigers and scored their lone run. Dallas center Grimes ends Fairfield's long streak. Third-ranked Fairfield entered Monday's Class 4A state quarterfinal round, riding a 22-game win streak. Eighth-ranked Dallas center Grimes made sure it didn't reach 23. Backed by a 4-run third inning, DCG took control and never trailed over the final four frames as it handed Fairfield its first loss since June 16th, a 7-5 on Veterans Diamond inside the Rogers Sports Complex. The Phillies, who were 20-9 in the state tournament field for the third straight year and 10th time in school history, advanced to Wednesday semifinals where they will tangle with 10th-ranked Winterset. DCG handed Winterset a 9-4 loss during the regular season earlier this month. Fairfield, who are 24-2, out-hit DCG 7-5 and had a pair of extra base hits to just one for the Phillies. But the Hawks also committed the game's only error, which led to a pair of unearned runs. Molly Cooney went 2-for-3 with a double and 3 RBIs for DCG. Cameron O'Brien roped a single that plated 2 runs, while 3 others, Aubrey Johansson, Kylie Maracle, and Morgan Rosenbeck, had one hit each. Hannah Simpson led Fairfield's offense with 2 hits, one of them a double and 2 RBIs. Trailing 6-2 entering the last half of the 5th inning, Fairfield plated 3 runs to close the gap to 1 run. DCG added an insurance run in the 6th, and then Grandview University pitching recruit Lainey Gannon slammed the door on Fairfield in the 6th and 7th innings. Riley Hall picked up the win in the circle. She went 3 2/3 innings for the DCG and fanned 3 before handing the ball over to Gannon, who went 3 1/3 and struck out 2. C.R. Kennedy pulls away. What makes Cedar Rapids Kennedy so tough to defeat is the fact that the Cougars are far from just a one-player team. Kaylin Kinney, who had not allowed an earned run in 51 innings entering this week, surrendered 3 to Pleasant Valley on Monday in the Class 5A state quarterfinals. But that wasn't near enough to slow down the Nebraska recruit or her team. Kinney helped her own cause with 1 of 4 home runs hit in the game, leading the Cougars to a commanding 10-4 victory and into the semifinals where they will meet Muscatine. That game is set for Wednesday at 11 a.m. on Veterans Diamond. Kennedy, who was 24-1 overall, features 6 players who have signed to play softball in college, including Kinney, who struck out 6 in 6 innings. She also finished 3-for-4 at the plate with 3 RBIs and 2 runs scored. Maya Dodge added a home run and drove in 3, with Keaton Gerber also going yard for the Cougars. Abby Spohr drove in 2, and Alyssa Martin added an RBI. Kennedy jumped on the Spartans early, scoring solo runs in the 1st and 2nd before plating 2 in the 3rd. With Pleasant Valley, 17-7 overall, pulling within 4-3 in the 6th, the Cougars exploded for 6 runs in the frame on 5 hits with 3 walks. The Spartans, who won back-to-back state titles in 2017 and 2018, did not qualify last season. Emily Wood had 2 hits and scored 2 runs, while Kristen Hartman struck out 7 in relief. North Scott advances in lopsided 4A opener. 5th-ranked North Scott took advantage of a shaky Charles City defense to score early and often on Monday to set up a rematch of the 2019 Class 4A state title game. The Lancers scored 5 first-inning runs, courtesy of just 2 hits and 4 Charles City errors, and cruised to an 11-0 5-inning victory in a Class 4A quarterfinal on Iowa Central Field at the Rogers Sports Complex. North Scott, who are 17-9, will challenge top-ranked Carlisle, who are 19-3, in the semifinal round on Wednesday. Carlisle nipped the Lancers 1-0 in last season's state final and the rematch will feature a combined 13 starters that were on the field a summer ago. Number 7, Charles City, who are 13-4, bowed out after committing 5 errors and connecting for only 5 hits. North Scott, meanwhile, ripped 11 hits, 4 of which went for extra bases. Sam Lee went 3-for-4 with 2 doubles and 2 RBIs in North Scott's rout of Charles City. Kylie Westland smacked 2 hits and plated 3 runs. Rachel Anderson added 2 hits, a double and a triple, and an RBI, and Taylor Robertson laced a pair of singles. Lydia Stout led Charles City at the plate with 2 singles. An RBI double by Anderson increased North Scott's lead to 6-0 in the second inning. Lee found the gap for a 2 RBI double in the third, and Newman and Westland added RBI singles in the fourth. Charles City threatened in the fourth when it loaded the bases with no outs, but North Scott hurler Ryan Cheek wiggled out of trouble with a pair of strikeouts and a lineout. Cheek fanned 8 in 4 innings of work before handing the ball over to Drew Lewis in the fifth. Carlisle moves on. Relaxed and in control from the opening pitch, top-ranked Carlisle sailed through the Class 4A quarterfinals Monday afternoon at the Rogers Sports Complex and inched closer to a potential second straight state championship. Utilizing small ball to near perfection, the Wildcats, who are 19-3, plated 2 runs in the first inning and 3 more in the second en route to a 5-0 victory over unranked Lamar's on Kruger Field. It set up a semifinal date with 5th-ranked North Scott Wednesday afternoon on Veterans Diamond. North Scott, who are 17-9, trucked 7th-ranked Charles City 11-0 in 5 innings in the quarterfinals on Monday. Carlisle Hall of Fame head coach Jim Flaws, the winner of 5 state titles in 35 seasons with the Wildcats, picked up career victory number 1,139 on the strength of 8 hits, 8 stolen bases, and 3 RBI sacrifice bunts. Meredith Hoffman and Kennedy Prenasil, Carlisle's numbers 3 and 4 hitters, laid down bunts in front of the plate to shove runs across in the first inning, and Molly Hextra followed suit in the second to stake Carlisle to a quick 3-0 advantage. "Our players were relaxed and we had our 3 and 4 hitters bunting," Flaws said. "It's so key to get those runs in the first 2 innings and it took the pressure off." Kennedy Preston followed Hextra with an RBI line drive base hit to right center, and a Lamar's error on an Aubrey Fernal ground ball moments later allowed the Wildcats to increase their edge to 5-0. Preston, who went 3-for-4 out of the leadoff position, is one of 6 returning starters off last year's state title team. "I think we have all been here before, and we tried to relax and act like it was a normal game," Preston, the Wildcats catcher, said. "We're just taking it one game at a time and playing like we know how." Isabel Noring served as Preston's courtesy runner and stole 3 bases that led to a pair of runs. Reagan Rowling also swiped 3 bases. 8 stolen bases, that's pretty good day," Flaws said. "If we get thrown out, we get thrown out." The early offensive production made Hextra's job inside the circle rather easy. The lanky right-hander yielded only 2 hits over 5 innings and struck out 5. Lexi Link took over in the 6th inning and retired 6 straight Lamar's batters, 4 on strikes. "Lexi doesn't get to pitch much, so for her to get 2 innings in, I knew she needed a little time pitching to live batters," Flaws said. "I know Molly wanted to go the whole way, but that's not how we operate." Hoffman had the game's only extra base hit, a 2nd-inning double into the gap in left center. Fernal, Rowling, Link, and Morgan Lose all singled for Carlisle, which is in the state tournament field for the 18th time. Lamar's, who were 14-6, making just its 2nd state appearance, was limited to 2 hits, a 2nd-inning infield single by Avery Pratt, and a bloop single to right off the bat of Brooke Haig in the 4th. Hextra and Link combined to retire 13 of the final 14 Bulldog batters. Lamar's freshman pitcher, Lizzie Kuntz, was responsible for 4 earned runs. She walked 3. Winterset advances 7-4. Jenna Young has a bright future in front of her, and the present isn't too shabby either. Winner sets freshman leadoff hitter set the tone Monday afternoon with a double on the second pitch of the Huskies' Class 4A state quarterfinal against West Delaware, and she finished 3-for-3 with 2 runs scored and 1 RBI to help her team down the Hawks 7-4 on Dodger Diamond inside the Rogers Sports Complex. Winterset, who are 15-7 and ranked 10th, pulled off the upset over number 2-ranked West Delaware, who are 21-5, by owning the early innings and reeling off 13 hits. The Huskies led 7-1 after 3 innings and then fended off a 3-run rally, all with 2 outs, by the Hawks in the last half of the 7th. Thea Banning joined Young with 3 hits. The two combined to lash 3 doubles. Natalie Drake ripped a single and double and drove in 2 runs. Ava Loudon delivered an early haymaker with a 2-run home run, part of Winterset's 5-run second frame. Young, who entered the contest hitting a team-best 595, connected for her second double in the second inning when Winterset roughed up West Delaware hurler Macy Klitsch for 5 hits. Briley Acton also found the gap for a double in the frame. Banning laced an RBI double in the 3rd to extend Winterset's edge to 7-1. West Delaware connected for 7 hits, 3 of them courtesy of Alyssa Holtz. Mia Payton smacked a 2 RBI single in the 7th inning. Banning earned the win in the circle for the Huskies. She struck out 3 and walked 1. Winterset, in the state tournament field for the first time since it won a 4A title in 2014, advanced to Wednesday's semifinal round, where it will face 8th-ranked Dallas Center Grimes, who are 20-9. The two teams met once in the regular season, a contest that went DCG's way 9-4 on July 9th. Albia makes quick work of Creston. It was an efficient and quick night for Albia as the Lady D's topped Creston in a Class 3A quarterfinal here Monday night, 12-0 in 4 innings. Alex Bird, Jenna Lawrence, Lauren Bayer, Danica Workman, and Ellie Spurgeon all drove in 2 runs each for Albia, who are 20-1 overall, who advances to face Mount Vernon Wednesday at 4:30 p.m. on Dodger Diamond in the semifinals. Lawrence earned the win, striking out 10 in 4 innings with just 2 hits allowed. She is a 5-year starter who has appeared at 4 consecutive state tournaments alongside classmate Beard. Abby Griffin, Lawrence, and Workman collected 3 hits each, with Beard, Bayer, and Spurgeon 2. For Creston, Sarah Keeler and Peyton Rice each had a base hit. And that does it for today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, July 28th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakrose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate.
Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on EarthDate.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.